This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. If you thought climate anxiety was bad enough, you ain't heard nothing yet. Our guest on this episode, Clayton Aldern, is a neuroscientist studying the consequences of the climate crisis for our minds, brains and bodies. The picture he paints in his new book, The Weight of Nature, is not a pretty one. He joined us for a live stream conversation with doctor and broadcaster Zan van Tulleken to tell us more.
First of all, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. I am extremely excited to have this conversation because I have the book in front of me. And when I was sent this book, I thought, okay, another book about the climate crisis. This seems very important. I should read it. And this is not really, to me, another book about the climate crisis. It reframes a number of issues in ways that are really remarkable. I'm a public health physician. I am extremely interested in the public health effects of environmental change. And this book frames it in ways that I had really not considered and raises some extraordinary issues. So, Clay, first of all, congrats on the book because it really is amazing. And I wanted to just start by asking you how you chose to frame it. You talk about climate rather than pollution or environmental toxins, but the scope of the book is massive and the number of topics you talk about is enormous.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. Why climate? The climate is changing, right? And I think that's a useful point and a useful nexus insofar as we can measure our own responses to change. And so really, this is a book about the brain. It's a book about free will. It's about the manners in which humankind is changing as a function of a changing world. What is a good mode of assessing that changing world? Well, taking a look at the climate, right? Because this is a reflection of change writ large. And so when I think about what's happening within us, when I think about all the manners in which mental health, neurological health, brain disease, right? These really intimate changes that are occurring on a large scale. When I think about those important changes within us, I want something against it to measure. And for me, that is the climate. The climate is this huge effect that throws those changes into stark relief.
I want to come on to all the different ways that temperature and different environmental toxins affect our bodies, because you dig into the neuroscience in a pretty extraordinary way. But can we begin with you start with memory and you start with the idea of the climate as a description, or as you say, a cultural expectation, the idea that there are old patterns in our brain and old knowledge in our bones. And so the climate in a way is a way of extracting normality from the sort of the chaos of weather. Talk about why you began with memory and particularly about forgetting, because I, you know, like a lot of doctors, medical students, I learned about memory was a big thing and forgetting is kind of pathological. And you really reframe that nicely.
Yeah, thanks. I love that question. I do start here because I think it's a point at which we can start to reframe our understanding of both the climate and the mind, right? And that's a big goal of the book, understanding the manners in which all these intimate processes are worth paying attention to because of the ways in which they're different from how we're used to thinking about them. So the climate is not a thing, right? It's not a concrete thing in the same way that a cup of coffee is a thing. The climate is an idea, right? It's a cultural expectation, as you suggested, right? The definition of climate is average weather, right? And an average is an idea of the mind, right? It's this arbitrary distinction. And so the first thing that we need to do here is think about the fact that we're talking about cultural expectations. We're talking about what we think about the world, what we think the world is going to look like at a given point in time. And then, of course, how those expectations change as this world does change in kind. And I think memory is a great locus to pay attention to those interactions. In part, that's because, I mean, think about the manners in which you, for example, remember weather. We could even say remember climate insofar as we have expectations about how long summer is supposed to be, right? Or the fact that it's supposed to rain in April. These are ideas that we hold about the world, and they're related to memories we have of our childhoods, for example. And yet, something really important is happening as the climate changes. And that's the fact that our memories become more and more inaccurate over time, right? Summer, as broadly understood, is longer than it used to be, right? As the climate changes and higher temperatures occur more frequently and at greater scales, right? This notion of summer is increasing in length. And so your memory of summer being a certain time length is inaccurate. Now, what are brains supposed to do? Brains are supposed to accurately model the world around us. And so it's important that they now form an idea of summer. They now form an idea of the climate as is currently occurring in line with the truth on the ground. And so forgetting is one of the neuroscientific tools, right? One of the neurological tools within our brains that allows our model of the world to be updated accordingly. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, we usually think about memory as this beautiful statue, right? This picture of the past, this kind of statuesque art form almost that we can peer upon and say, okay, well, that's what happened. That's what this thing looked like. But if that information isn't accurate, then of course we're going to need to understand the current state of the world in new terms. And that's what forgetting does. Forgetting is an active biological process in the brain that competes with memory. It competes with this static and a statuesque view of the world. And it says, well, actually, we need to kind of scrub some of this out a little bit. We need to update our model. We need to update this picture because it's not static, right? The climate is changing. And so what forgetting processes do in the brain is they allow you to navigate the world in a manner such that you're not surprised when you encounter new information, right? If you remembered everything, if you remembered every detail you ever encountered, you wouldn't be able to navigate the world successfully because you'd be stuck in the past. And so, of course, forgetting as a neural process is an essential one when it comes to survival. The problem is that because it does compete with memory, we're, of course, almost forced to forget what it was that the world was like before it changed.
Can you quickly talk about Clara Hitchcock, who's this early 20th century Yale psychologist, and you say she hated memory. She despised its dominance in her nascent field of psychology. Why did you pick her, and what's the thing that you got from her work?
Mm. Clara Hitchcock is a fabulous writer and a fabulous thinker who I think unfortunately was deeply misunderstood in her time. This is around the turn of the 20th century. She's one of the first women who attended Yale at the doctoral level. And she writes this dissertation called The Psychology of Expectation, right? She cared about expectation as a psychological process, not memory, right? Because in her mind, again, memory was this portrait of a past. It was this static, unchanging picture that said, here is what the world looked like. It sat on a shelf waiting to be recalled. But people don't navigate the world successfully by just recalling their memories, right? They use those memories and their beliefs in conjunction with expectations about the world in order to move through it. And so, you know, she did almost have this disdain for memory insofar as she said, well, listen, if we didn't have memory, we honestly would still be able to form expectations about the future and at least have some semblance of an experience of navigating the world successfully, right? Because we would be able to look forward. Memory is all about looking backward. And what this reorientation did in psychology is it made folks pay a little more attention to the future. And I think what's useful about that reorientation is that it almost elevates this notion of expectation to the same pedestal, right? That everybody loves memory, right? And this is true of neuroscientists as well. It's widely studied. It's a miracle, right? This is a biological miracle, of course, that we with our brains can form these associations of impressions we receive from our eyes and ears and noses, right? We can stitch these impressions together and store them away for future recall. That's magic, right? That's fabulous. But what Clara Hitchcock said is that's not enough to navigate the world successfully. That's not enough to be a human or an animal that survives in the world. In order to do that, you can't just look back. You have to look forward. And so expectation as this psychological good, as this psychological process that helps us survive, when we think about a changing climate, for example, it's important to understand that there's this alignment between Clara's ideas about a future orientation, this survival instinct that is necessarily cued by expectation, and our understanding of the broader world, right? Again, we already noted earlier that climate is expectation, right? Climate is cultural expectation insofar as it represents a series of beliefs we have about the way the world is supposed to look. And so as the climate changes, our expectations are necessarily changing, right? And so that to me represents one of these really, really intimate links between climate change and psychology, right? Cultural expectation changes and our interiority changes in kind.
So what you do there, because Clara Hitchcock says, which I never thought, she immediately makes, and you immediately get the reader thinking to the future as well as the past. And she says, expectation is a simple mental process which has the same relation to the future as memory has to the past. And so you're dealing with these quite theoretical, almost philosophical ideas. And then you cut to Daniel Pauly, the fisheries scientist. And he talks about how his colleagues are a bunch of amnesiacs. Explain then this very deliberate act of forgetting that's built into the science.
Yes, right. And this is purely a function of the fact that we only have one life to live, right? So Daniel Pauly's idea was that every generation of scientists necessarily starts from their own baseline. This is called shifting baseline syndrome, that as new generations of scientists rise through the ranks, they go through undergraduate, they attend grad school, they enter the field and they make a statement about that field with their research. They've only ever had the experience of their field, just as we've only ever had the experience of our own lives, as long as they've been alive. And so normal for them, right? Baseline for them may be wildly different from what baseline or normal looked like for scientists of a previous generation or the generation before that, right? we can come to terms with some of these baseline changes if we really pay attention to the research, right? If we're careful about reading empirical studies of the climate, for example, or in Daniel Pauly's case, he wasn't a climate scientist, right? He was a fisheries scientist. He was talking about fish stocks and the fact that it seemed to him that generation by generation, fish stocks always seemed normal to the scientists studying them, right? There were always a normal amount of fish in a given region. But the long-term trends obviously suggested otherwise. And I think that's the important point here, right? That we have expectations about normality, right? It's not just expectations about the future. Psychologically, we have expectations about normality that are wholly a function of the fact that we form beliefs about the world as we live our lives. So Pauly's point was that we're doing one another effectively a disservice by neglecting insights and experiences of previous generations. And this shifting baseline notion, right? This shifting baseline syndrome that he describes, it's everywhere, right? If you ask conservation scientists about the number of species, right, the amount of biodiversity that strikes them as normal, right, this type of answer changes from generation to generation. And so it's another form of forgetting, right? It's a cultural forgetting that's almost baked into the pie.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
It's like bureaucratic forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
So you begin with kind of shaking up people's relationship between memory and expectation, with the way that we interpret and hold information, both in our bureaucracies and kind of in our bodies. But you then kind of hit very hard on this quite metrics driven, quite kind of hard research driven, like, what does it mean for us all when things get hotter? And there are a few, few bits. You talk about Lee Kuan Yew, the founding father, first prime minister of Singapore, saying air conditioning was a most important invention for us, one of the signal inventions of history. It changed the nature of civilization by making development possible in the tropics. Basically saying without air conditioning, it was very hard to work in the heat. You have this amazing quote from a Finnish policeman who says cold weather is the best police. Like, people just don't commit crimes when it's cold. You track an entire murder of a Tyson Murlock, associated with the extreme heat in the USA. You're looking at data from baseball players, from damselfish, from rhesus monkeys. Just paint a picture of the kind of data that says, as it gets hotter, things get worse.
Yeah, gladly, or perhaps not so gladly, because this is some grim evidence. But listen, we just spoke about expectation. And these cultural expectations we have about the way the world is supposed to work, they also inform how we interact with that world, right? We know, for example, roughly how we're going to behave when we encounter another person, because we have an expectation about what it means to be a social animal, right? We know how to attend school. We know how to do our jobs. We have patterns that we tend to follow insofar as we know how to act on what we expect of ourselves and what the world expects of us. And yet, one of the things that extreme heat does, one of the things that air pollution does, right, is it injects a further poison into that model. It injects all kinds of changes to the underlying neurochemistry of behavior. And you've cited many examples here. A great place to think about these interactions is indeed in the classroom, right? So we know that students are not as great at taking tests, right? Standardized tests. This is true all around the world when extreme heat comes into town. It's also true that office workers aren't as good at performing their jobs, right? And in particular, the manner in which cognition appears to be a function of something like the weather is that as heat rises, impulsivity appears to rise in kind, right? We're not as good at the kind of slower, rational, critical thinking that we may be able to employ at temperate temperatures. And this has been observed in dozens and dozens of contexts. And it's true in many, many parts of the world at many spatial scales, right? You can look at the level of the individual, right? If you compare someone against themselves at different points in time, it appears that we're less good at taking math tests, for example, at higher temperatures. You can also look at the level of the city. You can look at the level of the nation state, right? When we think about impulsivity, unfortunately, one of the vectors by which impulsivity manifests is violence, right? We're more likely to respond violently to perceived acts of aggression when we come in contact with those acts in the heat, right? One of the things that heat does is it encourages us to interpret otherwise benign interactions in the world as aggressive. And so when we come into contact with perceived aggressive behavior, we're going to respond accordingly. And again, as you suggested, we see this in the postal service, right? We see this in baseball. We see this in football. At higher temperatures, penalties are more aggressive. Baseball pitchers are more likely to strike their opponents with their pitches. And so this notion of aggression being a function of warming weather, is just as concerning as some of these neurocognitive effects. I think what's really compelling about this evidence base is that, listen, we've had centuries to understand it insofar as we have observed the relationship between ambient temperature and impulsivity for almost as long as, you know, one can imagine humankind existing, right? Because we all know what it feels like in the heat. We all know that we're a little more ornery. Maybe we're a little quicker to the trigger, right? We're a little less rational. And yet what we're learning today is that there's a neurological reason why that's true. And it appears to be the case that high temperatures, right, extreme environmental heat acts specifically on the region of your brain that's responsible for rational thinking, right? And so the chunks of your prefrontal cortex, right, that evolutionarily new brain matter in the front of your head, the chunks of that prefrontal cortex that receive inputs from the more emotional areas, like the amygdala, they get to act more elevated than they otherwise would. And so heat appears to suppress these rational signals and therefore increase the influence of the more emotional signals, right? And so it's no surprise that we're, you know, less cognitively with it in the heat. In fact, we're playing to the whims of our emotions much more readily.
You have this delicate job to do in the book where you're talking about the cognitive problems of, for instance, doing an exam at a higher temperature. And you say, as temperature rises, opportunity falls. And my first thought when you start to talk about these kind of hard metrics of human performance is that there's something a bit uncomfortable about going, look, it's just that people are going to work less hard and commit more crime. And in fact, you address that very directly and say researchers often frame their studies of heat and cognition in terms of productivity and economic output. In the parlance of economics, when you invest in climate adaptation, you're investing in human capital. But that's kind of the problem. The fable of endless growth is what helped begin to boil the oceans in the first place. To reduce learning to human capital accumulation is to minimize the magic of these leaps of faith. So you've got this, you're having to, it feels like you're not just going, there's a good economic case to make sure your classroom is air conditioned, but that you were going to lose something much, much more fundamental about our humanity.
Yeah, I think that's right, Zand. I mean, to me, this is a story of intimacy, right? This is a story of a profoundly intimate relationship between people and everything else, right? This nebulous everywhere we call the environment, right? This isn't just a story of productivity and economic losses, right? Which are certainly there, right? It's true that as temperatures increase, productivity falls. And so there are going to be economic hits as a function of decreased productivity and increased absenteeism in the workplace. It's true that people are less likely to graduate on time if they're losing points on something like the SAT because of increased temperatures on test days. We know this to be true. And yet those economic effects, they aren't the whole story. I think what's really important to take away here is the fact that we're witnessing a profoundly intimate intrusion of environmental forces on our innermost spaces, right? And to me, what this raises is the fact that we're not as free as we'd like to imagine we are, right? This is kind of a story of free will, right? If something like the heat is forcing your hand in so far as you may be more likely to respond violently if you perceive a threat, what does that mean for the human agency that you believe that you have, right? If we can provably say that environmental changes are acting on your behavior, what does that mean for free will? And so I think that those types of questions, the questions that concern our intimate relationships with ourselves, those to me are where we ought to be spending our energy in terms of thinking about the implications of this work.
There are two chapters in the middle of the book called Blooms and Spilling, where you talk about algal blooms and about brain-eating amoebas. And these are both things that I'm aware of. You know, algal blooms, not good. Brain-eating amoebas, not good. But you frame them quite differently. Can you talk about those two issues?
Yeah. Again, I'd say I'm happy to, but this is a bit more grim news. Listen, we know that there are plenty of vectors of brain disease out there in the world. Things like ticks and mosquitoes, right? There are various protozoans that can cause things like cerebral malaria, right? So many of these disease vectors are expanding their habitable range as a function of climate change. And so when we think about, again, the relationships between a changing climate and our interiority, right, this intimate space inside our heads, it's not just about behavior, right? And it's not just about expectation. It's also about physical brain health. It is about the relationship between a changing climate and the health of our very neurons, right? So infectious brain disease and zoonotic brain disease, right? Brain diseases that come from animals, they're set to increase under a changing climate. It's simply true because as these habitable ranges increase, as ticks and vampire bats and the types of mosquitoes that cause things like Zika, for example, as the climate changes and these habitable ranges increase, simply as a matter of billiard balls bouncing off of one another, right? People are more likely to come into contact with these disease vectors. And so we can expect to see brain diseases rise in kind. Now, it's also true, as you suggested, that one of the things that a changing climate unfortunately does as well is not just increase the extent to which we may come into contact with disease vectors like ticks and mosquitoes, but also increase the extent to which we might come into contact with neurotoxins. And so this is where blue-green algae enters the equation, right? As runoff from agricultural systems increases as a function of severe storms, for example, right? You've got all this synthetic fertilizer in the soil that runs off into rivers as storm intensities increase. What does that fertilizer do? Well, it fertilizes algal blooms. And cyanobacteria, otherwise known as blue-green algae, is one of these organisms that is well known to produce a potent neurotoxin that is one of the most compelling causal explanators for something like ALS, right? Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. This is Lou Gehrig's disease, motor neuron disease. And so as these algal blooms, these toxic algal blooms increase both in size and frequency with the changing climate, unfortunately, we're more likely to see further incidence of those neurodegenerative diseases that are a function of the neurotoxin released by these blooms. And so, you know, I think that these interactions for me are just another piece of the puzzle. They're another piece of this puzzle illustrating the intimacy of our relationships with a changing world.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You talk about Muscoma Lake in New Hampshire, and this was the thing that struck me so much. If I think about my public health training, you know, I did a public health degree in the US in 2009, and you know, the effects of climate change were very bad for public health because of refugee movements, because of loss of housing, because of storms that would harm you, because of broken sewage systems that would get overwhelmed. So you get in, but instead you're describing a lake with an algal bloom that gives off an airborne toxin that seems to gently ease up the risk of getting amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, one of the worst neurodegenerative conditions you could really get, on the sort of downwind shore. So these sort of patterns that you can only start to look for once you start to cast the problem in this light. So in terms of how to investigate things, what to measure and where, what enters into the play of what matters to researchers, the way that you frame things really looks very different to even what I was studying 10 years ago. I mean, the brain-eating amoeba, again, that was something I was aware of because a friend of mine who's a GP said I had sinus problems, and he said, wash them out with one of those squeezy bottles. And the instructions all said use distilled water. And I thought, no, I can't be bothered. I use tap water. And then I thought I should just check. So I Googled it. People hosing tap water up their brains for sinus, up into their noses for sinus rinses, a small little cluster of cases of people getting brain-eating amoebas as a result of it. So I bought gallons of distilled water and sort of then never really bothered washing my nose out. But anyway, this sort of pattern of that's how it intruded in my consciousness. But even then, I had not connected it to climate change.
It's another great example, right? The fact that, again, we have a changing climate increasing the likelihood that somebody is going to come into contact with not quite a disease vector, just truly the harmful organism itself, right? In this case, an amoeba. People are, you know, always going to jump into lakes, for example, but they're going to be jumping into lakes more frequently as temperatures rise, right? That's what children do. But this is a freshwater amoeba that seems to thrive at higher temperatures. As people come into contact with it, unfortunately, it's something on the order of 97% fatal, right? And as you suggest, we're not really paying attention to the epidemiology here. In the same way that, you know, before I started researching this book, I wasn't really thinking too much about vampire bats, for example. But vampire bats are, you know, a carrier of rabies, right? This neurological disease that, yes, we do have a vaccine for, which is great. But all of a sudden, we're needing to consider our surveillance systems again, because the habitable range of the vampire bat is increasing, you know, globally northward. So whereas in the United States, for example, a couple decades ago, it never would have made sense to be surveilling vampire bats in Texas. Now the CDC is doing that because they're creeping northward from Mexico. And the same is true of this amoeba that you mentioned, right? We probably are catching something on the order of, gosh, a quarter of global cases, because we simply aren't aware of the fact that this is one of the things that people unfortunately might come into contact with. And so when patients present,
expectation and memory and the positions, you know, you learn all the things, you're trying to remember them all. But if your expectation isn't a brain-eating amoeba when you're presented with a kid with neurological symptoms, you're never going to get the right treatment.
Exactly. We're not paying attention to it because we haven't really had any reason to pay attention to it until now.
You talked about, like, when you started writing this book, you were not thinking very much about vampire bats. I mean, and I have to say, like, I would recommend this to anyone who wants their brain stimulated. Like, there is a lot in here, and you really range from quite philosophical things to very kind of cultural anthropological things, all the way to the specific neurotransmitters that are affected by different climate events. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, how you wrote it, how long it took to write, how you chose the voice and the tone for it? So it's not actually a gloomy book compared to a lot of books on climate change I've read. I mean, it's got some strong stuff in it. But yeah, what was the process of writing it like?
Sure. Well, my training is as a neuroscientist, right? And in 2015 or so, I found myself in what was effectively a windowless lab, uninterested in continuing to spend my life in a windowless lab, but I was still interested in the brain, right? And the reason the brain felt pressing to me as this kind of locus of focus, right? This point that I wanted to spend thinking about is because, you know, evidence had begun to suggest that climatic forces were bearing on brain health. And you know, a great example of that was the Department of Defense, for example, in the United States released that year this report that said climate change, you know, has something to do with security, right? It's a security threat. And the report wasn't suggesting that this was a function of rising seas. It said it was a function of exacerbating social behaviors, right? Exacerbating social tensions between people, for example. And so that was kind of a head scratcher for me because, you know, I'd heard whispers that there was this potential relationship between climate and conflict, but I'd always kind of envisioned those relationships as having something to do with some of the economic forces we talked about, right? Like drought is something that can make people desperate. But all of a sudden, there was the Department of Defense. There was this fabulous paper that came out of Stanford arguing something similar. There were these, you know, really thoughtful scientists and economists and cognitive neuroscientists beginning to rally around this idea that actually there was maybe something outside of the anthropology, outside of the economics, inside us that was changing as a function of a changing climate. And that to me was a pressing enough idea to indeed abandon that windowless lab and start to write about this process, right? Start to research and write about what it meant for this world that was all around us, changing slowly at times, rapidly at others, what it meant for it to be reaching in and changing us in kind, right? And so, you know, what did writing this book look like? I tried to take a neuroscientist's view. I tried to ask healthily skeptical questions about the extent to which we can ever separate environmental influence from, say, anthropology or economics, or all the other reasons that people behave the way they do, separate environmental influence from those other fields and just pay attention to the really specific manners in which it's acting directly on decision making, directly on brain health. And asking that question over the past 6 years has led me to this book. And so, you know, why have I chosen to write it the way that I have? As you suggest, it's not necessarily a story of all doom and gloom. I'm not trying to leave people in the fetal position here. And in part, that's because I don't think I need to, right? We've spoken a lot about some pretty scary effects of a changing climate on the brain. But my point here is not that we ought to be terrified and therefore do nothing, right? My point is that coming to terms with the intimacy of these relationships, I think, is that which allows us to recognize the degree to which we're intertwined with the environment, right? Climate change is already here. It's inside us. And policymakers are always telling us that, you know, the climate problem demands emotional engagement if we're ever going to act on it. And what I argue is that, well, if the climate is already inside us, if it's changing our brains today, we already have that emotional engagement, right? We are intimately linked with this problem. And coming to terms with that intimacy, I think, is that which is going to allow us to respond to the problem appropriately. And so that's what I'm trying to do with this book. I'm trying to paint a portrait of the intimacy of these interactions, and leave folks with the idea that it's not necessarily true that the terrifying nature of the interactions in question needs to leave us somehow incapacitated or frozen, right? Instead, I think coming to terms with these relationships is that which can motivate connection between one another and motivate an understanding of connection between ourselves and the world around us.
And at the end, you talk about empathy and planetary connection and talk about that almost in quite an optimistic way and say, rather than feeling, you know, gloomy and stressed about it, we can sit with our grief and our anxieties together. And that is a way forwards. I want to ask you about the work you're doing now with the International Neuroclimate Working Group. Conscious that I've just read the book and it is a very impressive book. Like, can you just talk a bit more about how hard it was to write, if it was hard? I mean, it feels to me like a book where you've genuinely gone on a journey where I imagine at the start of the book, you did not know what this book was going to look like. And it has kind of pulled together a very wide variety. Like, you must have had to learn it. Like, your own interiority must have been quite rearranged through the writing. Is that, can you just talk a bit, like, as an author, what was it like to do?
Yeah, happily. I mean, again, I'm a neuroscientist. I am not a psychologist. I'm not an economist, right? I'm not a historian. And yet you'll see a lot of that type of research in the text. And part of the reason this book is so interdisciplinary, and was indeed, you know, a reasonably difficult act for me to write, is because so much of the research is siloed in that manner. Right. We've known of these intersections between the climate and behavior, between the environment and the brain for years and years and years. But it's not like there's a field out there called, you know, climatological neuroepidemiology or something. Right. That's a field that I kind of had to invent in my head. And what that invention looked like was stitching together these findings from a handful of fields that I saw as very closely aligned with one another, that ought to be in dialogue with one another, but ultimately weren't, right? It's not like there was a neuroscientist out there who was explicitly asking the question in the lab, what if a changing climate came to town? What would that mean for the health of individual neurons in the prefrontal cortex, right? Those experiments weren't being run. And so I think it was incumbent on me to ask a couple of speculative questions to folks, about the degree to which existing empirical studies could be woven together, and then ask, you know, what this all meant for our future, right? Because again, the climate is changing. We are in this. This is not a future problem. It's happening now. And unfortunately, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. And so thinking about these intersections today with an eye toward the future, with an eye toward adjusting our expectations accordingly and adjusting our behavior accordingly, you know, that seemed like a task worth pursuing. You know, you mentioned the International Neuroclimate Working Group. So this is a new group that is on the verge of actually having its first meeting, right? We've just assembled. And, you know, part of the notion here is to bring together these disparate fields and ask what kinds of collaborations, both in terms of the science and in terms of policymaking, for example, might be possible when you sit these disparate folks down in the same room. Right. One problem that I can see in front of us right now is that in terms of cost benefit analyses and in terms of pricing the climate problem, policymakers aren't taking neurological health into account. Right. And that's really unfortunate because for better or for worse, climate action depends on those expenditures being justified. Right. Climate action needs to be proven to be beneficial in humanistic and fiscal terms if we're ever going to solve this problem. And so we need to be able to show, as folks interested in a livable future, that climate action is justified. And I don't think that we're doing as great a job as we could be if we're not taking neurological costs into account, right? If we're not taking the cost of increased frequencies of these algal blooms into account, right? Which are one of these causal risk factors for something like ALS. If we're not pricing that future neurodegeneration, right? If we're not pricing these productivity costs of diminished cognition, when we're thinking about the effects of climate change, when we're thinking about the costs of the climate problem, then I don't think we're doing our jobs as policymakers. And so part of the goal of the working group you mentioned is to conduct those kinds of analyses and further them insofar as they're being taken into account when we do seek to justify climate action.
A lot of the book is bearing witness to an unfolding tragedy that, as you say, is not something that's going to hit us. We are already living in it. And it seems like you've chosen the way you bear witness very carefully. So although you're talking with a good deal of urgency about very serious medical problems, you're I don't know to what extent you have to worry about kind of sounding hysterical or getting people so upset they turn off. I mean, there's a very funny bit right at the start of the book where you say there's a certain kind of introduction to a certain kind of book written over the course of the coronavirus pandemic. And it goes, can I read this bit?
No, please. Yes.
And then the world changed, and we recognized the degree to which everything was interconnected, how your health influenced mine, how structural power dynamics shaped access and opportunity. And we realized this project wasn't just a collection of pirate-themed cocktail recipes, it was also a history of empire and white supremacy. And you're like playing with this hyper-earnestness that suddenly permeated everything through coronavirus. And then later on, in the next page, you say, I submit perhaps a bit too earnestly for a book I'm encouraging everyone to take seriously, that we have to keep each other afloat. That line I really found interesting is like, you're actually trying not to be too earnest. You're trying not to be, I don't know, too loud or too hysterical about it, but to kind of offer this delicate, emotional, rational account that doesn't, I don't know. Like, can you talk about that? How much of a juggling act that was for you? Because there must have been moments where you're like, everyone's brain is about to be eaten by a bacteria if you swim in a lake. Come on, everybody, we've got to do something about this.
Yes, yes. And yet we know, right, we know that that kind of storytelling isn't necessarily effective, right? Folks, I think, are tired of the alarm bells of climate change being rung. And that's true because, A, many of us believe that this problem is real and it is urgent, right? And so more urgency isn't going to motivate change. I think to me what motivates change is, again, to use a word that I think we've deployed a couple times over the course of this conversation, intimacy, right? I think intimacy and internalization, right? And a certain personalization of the climate crisis is that which can motivate change. And so that's what I'm trying to do here, right? I'm trying to both put myself into the writing, right? Put myself into the argument, think about the manners in which all this stuff is bearing on me, right? I have a brain, just like you have a brain. These are not theoretical constructs. These are things that are happening to us right now. And part of what I'm trying to do here is sit with that and think about what it means for the way that I relate to the world. Again, you know, I think right after the, you know, kind of cheeky section that you read in terms of a certain kind of introduction to a certain kind of book, we've all read books like that. And I seek to say after that section, I don't profess the same degree of moral clarity that I think a lot of those books have. I think the implications of this research are a little more ambiguous, right? And that's not to say that they don't prescribe some kinds of interactions that I think we ought to be having with the world. But in terms of whether or not free will exists, right? That's a really sticky, ambiguous question. And what does it mean that the environment is reaching into our brains and modifying our behavior? What am I supposed to do with that, right? What am I supposed to do with that as someone with a brain and an experience of agency in this world? Am I supposed to throw my hands up and say, well, gosh, I guess nothing matters because environmental influence is steering my behavior? I don't think that's the right response. Unfortunately, some people do argue as much, right? Some people do argue for that kind of hedonism. And I don't think that is necessarily the route we ought to take. I think that we ought to take this intimacy and indeed think about what it implies for empathy, what it implies for the manners in which we relate to one another. Because again, this is something that we are all going to feel, right? A changing climate doesn't care about borders, right? Or generations, right? It is just there. And similarly, we all have brains, right? And so there's something about this experience, despite indeed the fact that it is going to be perhaps felt to a more extreme extent by some people more than others, right? I think there's a very important environmental justice angle here to discuss. Despite the disproportionalities that are likely to play out, this is above all else a universal human experience, right? We all live in the climate and we all have brains. And reckoning with the relationships between the climate and the brain, coming to understand the fact that this, what I call planetary empathy, that we feel is very much a part of the universal human experience. I think grappling with what that implies for our decision making and our relationships with one another, that's one of the main set of questions that I'm trying to grapple with in this book. And so when you ask me about, you know, tone and approach and moralizing versus, you know, taking a slightly more laid back or otherwise conversational approach, many times what I'm trying to do in my writing is sit down and just have a conversation with folks, sit down and say, this is shared experience. I don't totally know what to do with it because it's a little bit scary, but maybe we can try to figure out what to do with it together.
So you have kind of landed us perfectly. I want to get, if people have questions, they can type them in and I've got them coming up on the screen here. So Clay, I'm gonna fire a few of these at you. And I think this question, it's probably one that you're expecting, but it kind of picks up on that, what you were just saying exactly. What is one step I can take now to feel better about climate change?
This is not a book that is replete with solutions, right? It's not a book that says, well, here's the problem. And then the last chapter is a bunch of solutions. That is not the book that I wrote. And in part, it's because I think the solutions are those that arise from dialogue with one another and an engagement with this evidence base, right? And multidisciplinary collaboration, right? Things like that. But again, that's not so satisfying for our individual selves. And so in terms of, you know, coming to terms with this future, in terms of thinking about facing the climate crisis with as much resilience as possible, I think about a couple ways of approaching that problem. One of them is to turn this evidence base on its head, right? We know, for example, that a changing climate is doing all sorts of awful things to our brains and minds. It's also true, however, that pristine nature, right? Green space, clean air, clean water. These things are very good for our brains, right? And so engagement with the outdoors is often quite neuroprotective, right? There's this really compelling evidence base that says exposure to trees, right? You've perhaps heard the notion of forest bathing, right? Spending time in, you know, close proximity to nature, engulfed by nature. These are things that are actually very good for our neurocognitive health. And so, you know, part of what I want to say in response to the, well, what should I do question is, don't spend all your time, you know, reading the doom and gloom. And in fact, don't even spend all your time reading about solutions. Like, part of the evidence base here of embodiment, part of what we're talking about in terms of the physicality of the effects, implies that you need to be in nature as well. You need to be exposing yourself to the world around you in a manner that ensures you're not necessarily only getting the influence of the environmental stressors that so much of this book is about.
I shouldn't say you don't propose solutions, because there is a bit where you talk about the soup being thrown on the Van Gogh painting, and and you say, I don't think you need to throw soup at a Van Gogh painting to see to be the change you want to see in the world. I recommend against it, not because it's ineffective, but you say you need to be weirder and goofier than the soup. With any luck, you'll surprise yourself. So it's a lovely, again, it's quite a meditative bit. Whoever controls the nonsense controls the world. But there is some prescription in there for reinventing a way of engaging with things, which I love.
Yeah, and I'll just very, very briefly add, you know, what do I mean by that? I do think that it's really important that we break ourselves out of our patterns. Because again, this is a function of expectation. This is a function of these, you know, kind of core psychological and epistemological beliefs we have about the world. It's shaking up those beliefs that allows us to engage with the world in a new manner, right? To engage with the evidence base, to engage with the environment around us, being able to interact with those types of features in new ways. You know, that's that which allows us to break out of those old patterns that I think are unfortunately part of the problem here.
Final question, because we've only got a couple of minutes left. You've touched on environmental justice. Are populations from different countries being affected differently? Populations within, such as people in slums or crowded cities? And that's from Sam. So can you kind of touch on, like, it affects us all, but it affects us all quite differently?
Yes, yes. And I think that's an essential question here. So we see these disproportionalities, we see the injustices occur both at a global scale, right, from country to country, and also within cities, for example, right? I mentioned, you know, the neuroprotective effects of green space. Green space is not distributed spatially evenly or uniformly across a city, right? I live in Seattle. I think something like the life expectancy between the greener, less polluted parts of Seattle and those that aren't, you know, is like 10 years. And so when we think about the disproportionate effects of climate change on people, right, sometimes that's true because of these spatial relationships. But, you know, it's also true intergenerationally, right? And that's an important point that I think is worth leaving us with. So many of these effects manifest in the unborn, right? And so epigenetic transfer of trauma is a real thing, right? And so when we think about the fact that something like a hurricane can roll into town and traumatize, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of people, we're not very frequently thinking about what that does to expecting mothers. And what the evidence base would suggest is that in addition to traumatizing people who are carrying unborn children, epigenetic transfer of trauma also results in neuropsychiatric conditions and an increased risk thereof in the unborn and later in those children as they grow up in life. And so when I think about injustice, right, what is a greater injustice than an increased risk of a neuropsychiatric disorder that you inherited before you even had a chance to speak, for example?
Clay, we're going to have to leave it there, but you've kind of, in that last answer, you've gone from meteorology to urban planning to epigenetics to generational trauma. I mean, it, just the book, this is the book, The Weight of Nature, Clayton Page Alden. It is genuinely, I know this is the kind of event where I'd have to say it was a nice book anyway, but genuinely really blew my mind. It's totally fantastic. I would recommend it to absolutely everyone. Clay, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. And everybody, thank you for coming and thank you for your brilliant questions.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking today and I'm so glad you enjoyed the book.
This episode starred Clayton Aldern and was presented by Zan Van Tulliken. It was produced by Nicole Wong and the editor was John Doughty. I'm Das Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.